Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to Day Beautiful. I'm Adam Vitkavage, and this is a podcast where I interview a debut author about their reading and writing history, what inspires them, their debut book from Genesis to editing it, and from querying agents to finally selling it. If you like what you hear here, check us out on daybeautiful.net and follow us on social media at daybeautiful. Today's guest was born and raised in San Antonio, Texas. She is the author of the flash fiction collection, Math for the Self-Crippling. Her debut full-length novel, Like Happiness, is out now. Please welcome Ursula Villarreal Mora. Hey, Ursula, thanks so much for being here. I just read your official bio, but I'm curious, what is your unofficial bio? Who is Ursula?
That's a great question. I am a... was born and raised in San Antonio, Texas, and my ancestors have lived for over 300 years in the stretch of land that is San Antonio to Monterrey, Nuevo León, Mexico. And I descended from oral storytellers.
Yeah, was storytelling a big part of your childhood then?
Yeah, but only in oral form. So I loved hearing stories that my grandparents and my great aunt would tell me growing up. I lived on the west side of San Antonio with them, and there actually wasn't even a library there for most of my childhood. We had towards the end of my childhood, we had a library van that would come in occasionally to a neighborhood called Las Palmas, which was across from the cemetery. But it was so far, it was too far walking for my grandparents and for me to get there. So I only was around books like at flea markets and yard sales and things like that. And so I was definitely connected to stories through them, but through books a little bit later.
Yeah. And now we'll flash back to your childhood in a little bit, but I always like to get this out of the way. Your book that we're talking about, Like Happiness, is a debut on a larger press. We'll talk about another book you had published as well. But what is Like Happiness about from your perspective? When you're pitching it to friends or family or strangers, what do you like to say about it?
So the most straightforward thing about it is a book about a young Latina woman who writes a fan letter to her favorite author, who happens to be Puerto Rican. He replies back, and then they engage in some sort of friendship, situationship for a decade. And the novel traces that, as well as her quest for self-actualization.
Yeah, the situationship. I enjoyed how the dynamics played out and her journey. And Day Beautiful is always all over the place. Talked about childhood, talked about your book. We're going to go back to your childhood. We will get to Like Happiness eventually, but I really do love to learn more about you, because so many people are going to ask about the book and maybe they're not going to ask about you. What were the first books, like at the flea market or at the library or wherever at school, that you really started connecting with?
Struggled as an early reader for a long time. In second grade, I really couldn't read. And so around like third or fourth grade, I started reading a lot of the Ramona Quimby books started making sense to me. So I read those and I loved them. And then I, at some point, was like, I need something challenging, something like beyond children's stories. And so my great aunt had bought a copy of To Kill a Mockingbird for, I think, 25 cents. It was a little hardcover that was an ex-library copy from, I think it was like a rummage sale or something. And she lent it to me. And I really enjoyed To Kill a Mockingbird. And I thought, wow, this is a really powerful story. So that was probably one of, the first adult books that I read.
Yeah, I think To Kill a Mockingbird is one of those books that everyone should read at different times in their lives as well. I think it's just a book where, teenagers and young people, middle school, high school, could read it and like get it. But then once you've lived a little and seen some things, you could reread it and just see different parts of the book and learn different things.
For sure.
Yeah. Do you have any books like that that you like to go back to and read and enjoy multiple times, or are you not a rereader?
I'm a fanatic rereader. I am rereading a book right now. I teach, and so a lot of the
Sure.
books that I teach, I have to reread with my students. So a book that I'm teaching is When the Reckoning Comes by LaTonya McQueen. It came out, I think, like during the pandemic, maybe
Yeah, a
or
few
so.
years ago, definitely.
Yeah, I'm rereading it. I just reread Confessions by Kanai Minato, which is that Japanese suspense book. I taught that too. There's a lot of books I reread. I'm teaching there this semester, which I'm obsessed with. The Bell Jar is a book I read in my teenage years a lot. And then I used to have this kind of tradition where every fall, like every October, I would celebrate October by rereading The Bell Jar and Franny and Zooey by Salinger. And the librarian at the school where I worked kind of like knew that fall was coming when I would go check out those books. And she would, I think, get a little nervous if somebody was checking them out like late September, like first days of October, like, are they going to be here for Ursula's tradition? But that's, I probably reread those like, I don't know, seven, eight times.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing. I have a similar tradition where I read Stephen King's The Body, which turned into Stand By Me. So it's just a novella, but I read it every fall. It just gets me in the like cozy reminiscing mood. Yeah, so I feel you on that. It's just sometimes it just triggers certain parts of your brain and emotion. I like that. During when you were reading those books and in high school, were you thinking about writing? Were you doing secret journaling? What was your writing experience like?
Well, as a child, I was always really stumped when people would say, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I didn't want to lie to people. I didn't want to say like, a doctor when I didn't want to be a doctor.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of friends who would say like, oh, I want to be a veterinarian because I love animals. And I always thought like, I love animals too, but I don't want to be a veterinarian. Like, I don't want to
Yeah.
give animals shots and like cut them open. And then I had, there was a period of time, maybe like fifth or sixth grade, where everybody's saying like, I want to be a marine biologist. I love dolphins or whatever. And I was like, I got to come up with something. Like, I don't want to be a nurse. I don't know. So I fell in love with reading in middle school. And so I used to say, I want to be a writer. And it was real. I was telling the truth.
Yeah.
And it was the most, and at the time, I just assumed that like I would always want to be a writer. It never dawned on me like, oh, I could change my mind. And my love of books fostered that and kept, that ambition going. And so I did know maybe by like 11 that I wanted to be a writer.
Did people in your like community, your family, teachers, like were they behind that, or were they more pragmatic, where it's like, no, maybe you should get a real job?
So I had an English teacher who I thank in the back of every single book of mine named Susanna Elizondo. I don't think she's going to be listening to this, but maybe somebody will tell her about this. She was the best teacher I've ever had in my life. And she was a middle school English teacher, and she told me at a very young age that I was a writer. And at first I thought, oh, that's very sweet. And I really, held her in high regard. So I thought maybe she's being truthful.
Yeah.
But then she taught a class on poetry once, and nobody understood what I think iambic pentameter or approximate rhymes. It was approximate rhymes, and nobody understood it but me. And she was like, I'm not explaining this right. Why don't you come up, Ursula, and explain approximate rhymes to people? So I taught approximate rhymes to my class, and maybe half the people understood it after that. And she was like, huh, you see, you're a real writer. And after that, I kind of believed her. So that was really encouraging. And then I come from a family, a very humble family, where my mother lived in a very impoverished neighborhood, where the teachers were very discouraging, especially to the Mexican American students. She was discouraged from going to college. You know, was told by a lot of her white teachers, you know, the colleges that you're interested in are too far. Your parents are never going to be able to take off from work to drive you there. So maybe you should just get a job and help them out. And so my mother actually really encouraged me to do whatever I wanted because she didn't have that opportunity. So my parents never encouraged me to do anything practical. And I'm really, really grateful for that because I think a lot of, you know, it makes sense to have a practical job for sure. And being a writer is very, very hard.
Yeah.
But we need writers also.
Yeah. You brought up like the idea of people not putting down Mexican Americans, but not letting them live up to their expectations, maybe. I want to like turn that on. Like, did you ever see yourself in media, in literature? Did you ever see yourself actually reflected, or did you have to pull like, oh, I'm kind of like this character from To Kill a Mockingbird, or oh, I'm kind of like Sylvia Plath, or did you ever see like Ursula in media?
Didn't see Ursula. The first time I had any sort of recognition or like, I would see books by, there's a writer who's not as popular now anymore named Ursula Hagee. And I would see her books in bookstores and I would think, oh my gosh, that's my name, like my first name on a book. Because I didn't see anyone who was Mexican American in books. And so the closest thing I got was my name. And then I saw Ursula K. Le Guin books in bookstores. And so that was exciting. Probably around the beginning of high school, maybe eighth grade or so, I learned about Sandra Cisneros and I read her books. I read House on Mango Street and I liked it a lot. I mean, I was a big fan of that book. And there were, you know, aspects of like food and things like that, culture that I saw. The characters themselves were not like me though. You know, in House on Mango Street, I think it's Esperanza's her name, I might be wrong, has siblings. You know, it's a really kind of loud, boisterous house. There, I believe part of it takes place in Chicago. I could be wrong, but if my memory serves correct, like I think it's Chicago. Anyway, so I saw things that could kind of sort of pass as something, you know, that was happening in my life, but it wasn't anything that I had that immediate eureka moment, like, yes. So I kept reading Sandra Cisneros, and I love Sandra Cisneros, but I wanted to, you know, at least with this book, depict Latinas, you know, who are kind of quiet and introverted because I hadn't read them. I don't know that I have to this day read a book about a quiet Latina.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you been thinking about this book for a long time, or was it years until you started Like Happiness?
I was thinking about, well, I started this book in around 2011, but I didn't start it as a book. I started it as a story. And, I knew that the protagonist was going to be Latina, and I just wanted to make sure that, you know, that she was a real person that people could relate to and not like a stereotype and not something that, someone who maybe subverts some expectations of what people expect from a book about Mexican Americans.
Yeah, and 2011, not to get too into your timeline, but I know you graduated from Middlebury, got your MFA from Sarah Lawrence. Is that around the time Like Happiness started percolating?
Yeah, it was my last year of grad school that I started writing this story. And I really had no idea where it was going and it didn't fit with my thesis. So I was just like, why am I wasting my time? This is my last year of grad school. I need to wrap up my thesis. But I was like, no, I really want to keep writing this. So I indulged myself.
In grad school, while you were working on other stories and your thesis, what was your experience like? I've talked a lot about MFAs with other writers and some loved it. Some were like, some hated it. Where are you at on that scale? How did it shape you and influence you?
I'm really grateful that I had those years to focus on reading and writing and to develop the habit of writing, because it's easy to not write. and life gets crazy. So I'm grateful for that. I had some great professors there. It was also not a very diverse program.
Mm-hmm.
So there were things, you know, said in class that weren't the most sensitive. And, you know, there comes a point where you have to, you know, take the feedback and decide, like, is this actually constructive? Can I do something with it? Or is it more like someone's just so unfamiliar with this type of story that this is their like gut reaction, but this isn't actually something I need to be internalizing. And so there was a lot of those moments too. I made a lot of great friends there. I put myself in tremendous debt there. So, you know, I don't regret going.
Sure. No, the diversity is something I've heard a lot. Obviously, I'm a white man and have not had a struggle in any sense. But like the more I've opened up my world to, you know, writers from backgrounds like yours, you know, writers from Africa who are now live in America, et cetera, et cetera. I really like have started putting myself or like trying to use a different lens on how I talk about stories, how I like how I see media and how I take it in, because so much of it is told through a lens meant for me because of X, Y, and Z. But yeah, I've heard that about like settings, like they don't get San Antonio because they've never been in a place like San Antonio.
Yeah, they really didn't get San Antonio. They really, really didn't. I got a lot of questions about the location and like, how can, you know, especially if there was one story I wrote in particular that I remember, this little girl's whole life is her grandmother's house and the yard. And they live in a neighborhood that's on a main street that gets a lot of car accidents. And they're like, how can this little girl just be so entertained in a house in a backyard? Like, why don't they go to the public pool? Why don't, you know, go to the library? And I'm thinking, you've never been to a place like this. You don't know what it's like. Like sometimes you are kind of circumscribed into a really small space and that's your life flourishes there.
Yeah. And I think stories like this or like that about places that aren't, so much of American stories have been told in like the same five cities. Like you get Chicago, New York, LA, San Francisco, fake middle America, right? Or Miami. But you don't get like, and I'm talking about like Hollywood media, not necessarily books, but it's like, you don't get these like smaller, like real cities that aren't, you know, like San Antonio is a major city, but like Phoenix is often misrepresented. I lived there forever. Yeah, I don't think I've seen San Antonio in anything super big. I know Shea Serrano is like a pop culture writer who I think his show is set there now. Anyway,
I love him. I love him. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, but so like now, like San Antonio, I feel I know a lot because of him. And I think that's like amazing what one person who's like honest and true can do for a community. And he's not the only voice, but like it opens up, you know, more voices.
For sure.
When you were writing that, this story that became like Happiness, what made you want to keep going? What made it a book?
So I didn't think of this as a novel. Like I said, I thought it was a story and I thought that I wanted to write a novel at some point, but I thought, what am I ever going to write a novel about? And how am I ever going to stick with it long enough for it to become a novel? And do I have the skills? And it was really easy to just kind of super overwhelm myself and paralyze myself. And so I thought, well, I don't have to think about a novel. I just need to like get this short story in a place where I'm satisfied with it. And so in doing that, I kept growing and growing and I didn't turn on my inner editor. Like I just let myself write. At some point it was like, I don't know, 320 or 60 pages. And I just let myself like try to figure things out by writing scenes and kind of developing things from there and seeing how people would react within the novel. And eventually I was like, I couldn't kid myself any longer. Like I was like, I have a novel here. And I think it was just, I just really liked being in this world, to be honest, as nerdy as that sounds. Like it gave me a really good escape from my day job and, and like every kind of worry. And it made me feel really good to be there and to develop it even further. And so that became, you know, something that I just did a lot.
Yeah. So you turned off your inner editor. What does that mean for you? Like, well, I guess when you're writing a story and your editor is on, what's the difference between how you write?
I think it's really easy to easier to turn off your inner editor when you're just have no expectation, mm-hmm. where you're like, nobody ever has to read this. I just have to like it and have fun with it. And I try to get my students to turn off their inner editor when they're writing too. It's really easy to write something, read it on your screen, you know, hate it because of whatever, your mild headache and like hunger and the font, and then just delete it. And that's not always the most productive place to be. And so just kind of like putting a goal for yourself, like today I'm going to write the scene, or today I'm going to write 300 words. And, you know, a lot of people say like 1,000 words. I don't even do 1,000 words. I'm like, if I can get 150 words down, I'm good today. Yeah. Or like if I revise 3 paragraphs, I'm good today. And so it's just, you know, not, it's just giving yourself like these, or at least for me, giving myself these really bite-sized things that I could accomplish without, you know, having to rearrange my whole day. Like I can write 150 words. It's cool.
Yeah. When you're writing those 150 words, I'm sure the goal changes, but let's say today you're going to write 150 words. What's the goal today?
The goal today is to write 150 words.
Just whatever it is.
Well, I actually have something due, but sure. So I have, you know, like, you know, it's easy to be, when people are asking you for things, you say yes. And so I said yes to something, and I'm going to get it done. Mm-hmm. I am a little busy. I'm still teaching. I do have a book coming out. I'm going on tour.
You have this going on?
Yeah, I got this going on. Really excited that I have this going on. You know, to think like, oh, I'm going to write this all like 2 days before it's due is just not feasible and not for me healthy. I can't get myself to do that, because knowing me, I'm also chronically ill. Knowing me, like that kind of pressure and expectation means that like I'm going to go down like a sinking ship at some point from, you know, fatigue or like, you know, some flare of some sort. And it's not going to happen. But if I do 150 words, it's going to happen. They don't have to be perfect 150 words, but tomorrow I can add like, I don't know, another 100 words, or 2 days from now, another 100 words. And eventually this all gets done.
Yeah. And like you said earlier, it's easy to not write, right? It's just easy to just be like, I'm good. I have a podcast to do. I got a class to teach. I have my life to live. The writing gets skipped. Are you a morning, afternoon, evening writer, or just whenever it happens?
I'm a whenever it happens. I often have 2 or 3 jobs at the same time. I wrote this novel when I had a full-time job and a part-time job. And so the only time I had then was to wake up at 5 in the morning, would walk myself to this. I lived in a medical center, which means that doctors were, you know, 24 hours around the clock, like in need of caffeine. And so there was a cafe there that opened at 5, and, you know, people would come in. And so I happened to live walking distance from this place, would wake up at 5, walk to this cafe and set myself down from 5:30 to about 7:20. And would work on my novels then. And, you know, the great thing about that cafe is like doctors don't stay to linger. They pick up their espresso and head out. So I basically had an empty cafe to myself before I went to work. And so it was great. And then, you know, I've often had 2 jobs, and sometimes the writing gets done at lunchtime, and sometimes it gets done on the, like on my notepad on like a bus ride home somewhere. Yeah. But most of the time it gets done.
Mm-hmm. When did like happiness turn from it's a story to I don't know what it is to, oh, I have like, it's 350 pages. I have something. Like when was like 2011 is when you thought of it. When was this like, oh, okay, here we go.
Probably 2016, 2017. Mm-hmm. Like I couldn't kid myself anymore. And people were like, you need a query agents. And, you know, like it's real now.
Yeah.
So yeah, probably around then.
What was it like querying agents? Like that's one of my favorite things to talk about, because I think it's like such a mystery to new and emerging writers. Like, yes, you query an agent. Everyone knows that. But what was it like for you?
Oh, hell. It was terrible. I actually think that querying agents is my least favorite. I mean,
Yeah.
hopefully I don't have to do that anymore. But it was bad. Nerve-wracking. The idea that, somebody can shape your career is a lot, the first few people that I talked to, I think that I liked some of the books they were representing for sure. I was very intimidated. I did not have that much confidence. And like so anything they said to me could really like make or break me, and it's hard at the beginning to have confidence and to be like, well, actually that's not a good fit, or like actually like something, just make a decision that isn't just a reaction to them. And so I met a few people who it didn't work out with. One or two I met in person, and like, you got to follow your gut instinct. Like, is this a match? Is it not? And I didn't actually get a match until 2019. And so it was kind of a journey. There would be periods where I didn't query at all because I just needed to focus on revising the book. And I thought, this is kind of a distraction and maybe premature to be looking for an agent at this point.
I have the more I talk to writers on the pod and off the pod, querying agents, I say it's my favorite, but it's because I think the more we talk about it, it helps people who are in your position now be like, oh, okay, like I can be confident to say this isn't a good fit because they're trying to turn my weird sci-fi into like a beach read or whatever, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
You get an agent in 2019. Is that with your like the Flash Fiction collection, or was it with like Happiness? Or talk if you can talk about what that was
Yeah,
like, yeah.
that was such a journey. So I had been querying agents for a long time, and I had a lot of agents tell me a lot of different things about like Happiness. One was like, this is kind of like Sheila Hetty's writing, but Sheila Hetty can get away with it, but you're Latina, so you can't. I was told this is a great book, but it shouldn't be your first novel. I was told so many things by great agents that have put out really great books, and so I at that point was like, okay, this person's not going to work out. This person's not going to work out. I got this agent. I was initially with Curtis Brown, the agency in New York, and I was elated. And we went out with this book in 2019, like maybe October 2019. And it didn't, the first round wasn't successful. And then my agent asked me to revise it. And we went out March 2020. That was a nightmare. And my agent also told me, like, I haven't sold any debut fiction in the pandemic. I think you need to maybe, start working on another book. We got to like kind of ride this out. We got to see what's gonna happen here. Like, I can only sell like books of people whose books I've already sold, and so you're in this unfortunate situation. But let's write it out. So I started writing another book, and by August or so, I gave her. It had been a book I'd been working on, actually. So it's not like I started it in March, but in August or so, I gave her a draft, and she was not feeling it. And I realized, okay, I'm stuck. Like, I can do a number of things. I can write a third book, and maybe she'll like the third book, or I can switch agents and see what happens. And so I switched agents and found another agent who is my dream.
Yes, good.
And I gave her like Happiness and she loved it. And she said, yeah, we'll see if we can sell this. And I said, it's going to be really hard because it's already been rejected. And she sold it at auction.
Terrific. Where does Math for Self-Crippling come in?
Oh, very good question. Yeah, I overlooked that. Yeah, so in this period where I ended with this other agent, I was super frustrated because I'm somebody who works on like five projects always at once. And so I thought, I have all these books that are never going to see the light of day. And so I also had been a bookseller, and I knew that little books like that don't really find big publishers unless you're George Saunders and it's called like Fox 8, and then you get like a little hardcover with a little dust jacket and it's cute. But other than that, even I think Sandra Cisneros has, one of these smaller books with a smaller press too, because shorter length, whatever. And so I thought, okay, I have this book called Math for Self-Crippling. I feel really strongly that it's done, and I feel like it's a book. And so I need to look for contests. And so I just looked for any contest that did not have a page limit. And a lot of the contests I found were chapbook contests. And though I do not consider Math for the Self-Crippling a chapbook, it is called chapbook because I won a chapbook contest. And I understand that. And for the rest of my life, people will be like, tell me about your chapbook. And that's fine. But I entered it in this period where I was unagented. And, that really helped me with, in so many ways, confidence-wise. And finally, like one of the files on my computer was no longer a file. It was going to be real and physical and exist in the world.
No, that's amazing. So you had your agent already, or because I'm very curious just about the timeline of this, because I'm a nerd. You win that, it gets published in 2022. You already had your new agent by then.
I did not very long,
But it
but
was,
yeah, she and I had been working on the submission and my revision of like happiness.
And just like from the business side, like what did that look like? And you were like, hey, I have this. Can I go out on contest? Or what's the relationship like between agent and writer at that point where it's like, I have something that's not, you're probably not going to want?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So I didn't think that my I didn't know, like honestly, I was in the dark about like how would Math for the Self-Crippling ever become a book. And it just so happened that like I ended things with my agent, and then I was unagented and I submitted to contest. And then I got my other agent, or a little bit of an overlap there. But I don't know. I mean, I think some people would have recommended that I sell a big book first, and then maybe this could like come out as something else with like more attention and prestige and more money behind it or something. But it happened the way it happened, and I'm fine with it.
The reason, like I mentioned this before we were recording, I talked to a writer friend here in Denver, and she has a short story collection that's weird, and she's like, it's probably not going to be like picked up by an agent, or a big press won't want it. So she's doing the con like the contest circuit now, and she used like Kristen Arnett as an example, who had these like really weird books before Kristen Arnett got like bigger book deals. And it's the industry is just so fascinating, is all I'm getting at. It's like half of it's a game, half of it's luck, and then 1% is talent. No, I don't know. I don't know. But it is all interesting to me. It's all interesting to me. Like happiness is told from multiple or dual, like it's dual storylines. Did one, was her story the one that came first, like her voice?
Yeah, for many years, it was just one timeline. And then when it sold, we had already started entertaining the idea of the second timeline. And so once the book sold and I was working with my editor on the revision, I had to write like eight chapters from scratch after it sold. So that also, as someone who's obsessive and likes to spend a lot of time arranging all the words in perfect order, it was a little bit of a stressful situation to be like, I've got these whole, like there's nothing there. It's all got to be new.
Yeah, that is crazy. How long did that process take when you added the second timeline?
About 8 months, maybe 9 months, maybe a little bit less. Actually, so I initially did it. I've mentioned that I'm chronically ill. I initially wrote the chapters, but I needed a surgery and my health was really declining. And so I submitted the chapters before my surgery. I had a surgery, And then when I came back from surgery and was recovering, my editor broke it to me like, yeah, these chapters, let's start over. So I actually had less time. So, but it was great because, you know, once I recovered from surgery, I felt fantastic. And I probably should have waited until after the surgery to even attempt it, but it was good to know what didn't work at first. And so then maybe I had like 4 months to write these 8 chapters. And I think they worked.
Yeah. That's so fascinating. So you have an editor, the book, you're under contract, you have to write all this new stuff. Do you ever feel like defeated in a way where it's like, oh, maybe this is all falling apart?
Well, I think it's really fascinating. I thought about this a lot during this process, to be an editor, to buy a book, and you know it's not perfect because you know it's going to need some work here, right? Revisions or a chapter, or 2 chapters, whatever, or add a character, or whatever the case may be. They must have such faith in us as writers because I think, especially on bad days, writing can feel like such an unraveling. Like if I pull this chapter, then like, you know, this chapter 4 down also falls apart, you know, and then, you know, if I change, you know, take out the fight these two people had, then there's going to be less tension over here. And, you know, it's so easy to, for the whole kind of like sandcastle to collapse. But in this case, it didn't collapse.
So now your book is out. How do you feel like you did it? It didn't fall apart.
It's surreal. I'm really excited. I could have easily given up in like 10,000 different times in my life, from, you know, it being a short story to, you know, the things that some of the earlier agents said to me about this book, to, you know, not having it accepted by my first agent. I mean, there's so many times that normal people would have been like, I've had enough. Mm-hmm. Let's shelve this. I'm not normal people. I'm really determined people. I'm elated. I'm like really glad that that I'm stubborn and persistent, and it's great. I was listening to another episode of yours with another writer, and I guess a lot of writers, you know, just, you just have to have faith that it's going to happen. And then when it does, there's this relief.
Yeah. It takes a long time to write a debut or publish a debut and write, publish, edit, everything. And that is one thing I love hearing from writers and like your journey, right? Like you thought of this in 2011 as a story, then really became a book 5 years later. And here we are 10 years after that. You know, it's, takes a while.
Long I mean, journey. Yeah, I think a lot of, unless you are like a born writer, like don't do it. It's really, there's a lot of other stuff out there that could be fulfilling. And this is, you know, an act of like devotion and love and persistence and, you know, uncertainty a lot of times.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad Tatum's story is out here. I'm glad you were stubborn. The book is out. You have multiple jobs. You're writing pieces for other things. Do you get a chance to read any? Like, what's for, I know you talked about what you're teaching, but for pleasure, what's on your radar?
So I, like I said, I read with my students. So mm-hmm. right now I'm waiting for the semester to end so I can get into my to read pile. And it is vast. So I want to read Enter Ghosts by Isabella Hamad. The British Palestinian writer.
Yeah.
That I want to read. There's a Junji Ito book that I have not read, which is called Tombs, that I really want to read. This summer, my goal is to read so many things. Malcolm X's book. Never read it.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Me neither,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah. Everybody was reading it when I was 16, and now I really want to read it. Mm-hmm. Let's see. Yeah, the autobiography Malcolm X is told by Alex Haley. Is that what it's called? I want to read Beautyland. Is that what it's called? Mary something Bertolino, right?
It's a purple book, purple and pink.
It's a purple book, yeah.
Yeah, Mariella Hilton Bertino.
Okay, yeah. I want to read that. I want to read all the thrillers and mysteries like ever, and I want to get cozy, and yeah. I want it to be rainy kind of in the summer, except on the days that I run, so that I can read all the thrillers and be in suspense.
Thank you so much to Ursula for joining the Day Beautiful podcast to talk about her debut novel, Like Happiness. You can find her on the internet at her website, UrsulaVillarealMora.com, and on Twitter and Instagram at Ursula of the Book. You can find me, Adam, at VitCavage on all social media. You can check out Day Beautiful at DayBeautiful.net and on all social media at Day Beautiful. And as always, I'm Adam. This is Day Beautiful, and you're all beautiful.